Welcome to the latest edition of the Insurers the Best Policy podcast. My name's David Bull, and today I'm joined by Tom Vandiver, head of the Financial Institutions Group for the Americas at Barclays. In his career as an investment banker, Tom has had a strong focus on M&A, financing, and risk and capital management solutions for the insurance industry, as well as other financial services companies. So he's really well placed to talk on a wide range of topics as the sector looks to position its balance sheets for market opportunities amid the COVID-19 fallout. In the first of this two-part interview, we discuss capital raising, startups and scale-ups, investor appetite, and how the pandemic has impacted M&A dynamics. So Tom, let's start by talking about post-COVID-19 capital raising. Where are you seeing the most activity? Is it in startups or scale-ups? And how does it compare to previous cyclical shifts? And do you think we're witnessing a true class of 2020?
Yeah, so very, very interesting. For the longest time, we have thought that, you know, sort of the classes, we had a couple big startups, obviously, going all the way back to the 80s. We had the whole class in the early 90s after Andrew, the post 9/11 class, and then we had the class of sort of 2005 post KRW. And for the longest time, we've thought that capital has gotten to a point where it's fluid enough. There are alternative technologies, if I can sort of use that word, like sidecars, that will make it such that effectively that cycle's broken and we won't have this on a go-forward basis anymore. Interesting, people are now referring to it potentially as a class of 2020. I personally think that the scale-up thesis has more legs than, you know, sort of pure NewCo thesis. And the reason for that is I do think the reason we sort of said maybe we'll never see like another class like we did post-KRW is because, you know, the capital cycle has shortened, right? Information technology and fluidity of capital has increased. That's something that, you know, has been a very long-term secular trend over the entire time that I've been an investment banker. And I still think that that's an important theme for people to consider, which is if we are truly in a classic hard market now, which it feels like, you know, maybe we are, particularly in property exposed lines and in reinsurance, how long will that actually persist? And if you thought that it was something that could persist for 3 or 4 or 5 years, then you'd say, okay, I've got plenty of time to, you know, invest in a NewCo. But because people's perception is that, you know, maybe that time frame has shortened up, I think that a lot of, you know, people that are looking to put capital to work are, you know, thinking about leveraging existing platforms. So if a company has existing licenses, already has, you know, sort of the operational platform, people in place, systems, underwriting, claims. And, you know, I do think a lot of companies that have entertained these kind of discussions have different pieces of that, you know, such that that conversation, I think, is a little bit more interesting than just a pure NewCo conversation.
So kind of on that theme, but how strong is overall investor interest in the P&C industry right now? And what's driving PE interest in particular in the carrier sector? Do you think they buy the hard market story, or is it more about limited opportunities elsewhere for them?
Yeah, look, I think there's a lot of interest. I think that, as you know, coming into this year, we were already, you know, seeing elements of a hard market. Certain parts of the market have really had a shakeout over the last 2 or 3 years, just given how tough the environment has been in CAT and maybe in broader property lines as well. The PE interest just, you know, stems from the fact that, you know, there are a lot of people in private equity that, you know, have focused on property casualty insurance and reinsurance over, you know, years and, you know, maybe even in some cases over decades. So, you know, naturally, when a market opportunity presents itself, people who, you know, have had that experience in the past are sort of programmed to look at it again. Look, I would say the interest is pretty robust, right? There's been public capital raises and quite a bit of conversation in the private equity community, and conversation sort of begets conversation. So I would say the interest level has been pretty high. I think that, back to what I was saying before, you know, is it a pure hard market story? Not necessarily. I think that's a catalyst for people to have conversations, but I also think that you can think of it a little bit as a hard market story plus, right? So it's not going to be sort of a pure financial trade, I don't think, for anybody that gets involved. I think it's going to be that hard market thesis serves as a catalyst, but then, you know, private equity is, you know, very disciplined. I think that the investors there want there to be something more than just a quote unquote financial trade. They want to build something that's got durable value that they can confidently look to monetize, you know, at the end of their investment period, whether that's in the context of an IPO or a sale. And it is interesting. It does play off of what's going on in the public markets. I think that public market interest in the sector has also been pretty robust. And you go through a period like this work from home period with COVID, and in some ways investors are sort of in the change business, right? When a big change like this happens, it forces you to sort of look at your portfolio and think about what the opportunity set is in sort of a different light. And I do think that, you know, is a very big catalyst just in terms of the breadth of activity that we've seen and all the thinking that's gone into it.
So you mentioned earlier, not just startups and scale-ups, but sidecars as well. So how much interest are you seeing from carriers in structuring sidecars and similar vehicles?
Yeah, look, I think it's very interesting. The sidecar is a very good vehicle when you sort of take a step back. It allows for customization of one's balance sheet. It allows for return optimization. You can utilize that capacity to, in an M&A context, to do a larger deal than you might otherwise comfortably be able to do. And, you know, from the investor side, it allows people to really target what they're investing in, depending on how the sidecar is structured, versus like buying equity in an insurance company where you get lots of different risks from being a public market investor. You can really target the risk that you're getting in the context of a sidecar, depending on how it's structured. So I think that, you know, sidecars are kind of here to stay. And I think what they get used for, though, can actually evolve over time. And one of the places, for example, that, you know, people are talking about utilizing sidecars is potentially to, invest in the runoff space. So, and, you know, our firm has done sidecars in the life and annuity space. We worked on sidecars that are specific investment portfolio type structures to get exposure to a different asset class than somebody might have otherwise had access to. And of course, I failed to mention, it's also a great way for a balance sheet heavy company to, you know, effectively get into the asset management business and be in sort of a, create some ballast to their business model through capital light. So I think I know there are parts of the sidecar market that in the reinsurance space that have had a little bit of a shakeout here, but I think the technology and the approach of utilizing sidecars was sort of with us to stay. And I do think there's a good level of interest in, you know, making new investments, just like I was saying, in terms of the startup or scale up thesis. I think sidecars definitely have a place.
Let's talk a bit about M&A and the COVID-19 effect. In your experience, what practical impact did the shutdown and financial markets turmoil have on M&A across the sector? And are we beginning to see a return to normal? And how has the deal-making process changed in response to the challenges that COVID-19 has presented?
Yeah, so look, the first part of your question, at the very outset of the pandemic, sort of mid-March, I think people really started, at least in New York, started aggressively shutting down offices, and the stock market had a huge retrenchment. And look, the M&A market, frankly, didn't go completely to sleep, but, you know, there was a dramatic pullback. I think, you know, there's sort of a normal cycle to M&A processes, right? There were certainly some situations that were far enough along that they just went ahead to completion. There were other things that, you know, maybe were midstream where people said, look, you know, now doesn't really feel like the right time. And certainly if you were planning on launching a process and but hadn't gotten to the starting line yet, I think a lot of those situations just got, you know, pulled away. So we saw a, you know, dramatic fall off just in M&A volume and, you know, talking to, you know, bankers across the street, pull back on pipelines. I would say that the way that the recovery has happened, you know, the capital markets really started to make a comeback first. And across the full spectrum of what a firm like ours does, there has just been a tremendous amount of new issue activity, first in the investment grade debt markets, then into the equity markets. And a lot of it, frankly, was in affected industries. So entertainment, transportation, we've just found that, and the whole street has found this, that, you know, there's a real appetite to sort of get involved in new issues where there's a good story about, you know, what things would look like on the other side of COVID. And I think, you know, seeing the dramatic recovery in the secondary markets, in the stock market and in credit markets, and just seeing a robust new issue calendar sort of across the piece, right? It's not just, it's been in, you know, all parts of the debt markets now, the securitization market, the non-investment grade market, as well as equity markets, I think has really served as a significant tailwind for M&A. And, you know, I'd say just in the last couple months, the M&A market has made a pretty strong comeback. So we're seeing levels, activity levels that are more commensurate with what we would have expected had there been no pandemic. And it's really interesting how the M&A process has evolved. It's funny how you go into a situation like this, and at first it's just shocking, but people are pretty adaptable and you get to a new normal. And our new normal is that, you know, we're conducting due diligence processes virtually, negotiations all being done virtually, and we're seeing new deals print. Now, I will say the one thing that is harder is if you don't know, if an acquirer and a target don't know each other, it's harder to get to know each other, right? So having a relationship with people ahead of time puts you kind of in an advantageous position. When you try to build new relationships over video or over phone, it's just harder to do than when you could actually go and, you know, meet in person. I do think that for buyers and sellers that have known each other for a long time, for, you know, maybe there are some conversations that started 2 years ago or a year ago or even 3 or 6 months before the COVID period hit us, I think those conversations are just naturally in a stronger position to progress than if you're sort of starting from scratch without a relationship.
Of course, distribution has been the focus of a huge amount of deal volume in recent years. So how have M&A dynamics changed post-COVID-19 in the distribution space in terms of both deal and consideration structure, as well as valuation multiples?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Look, the distribution space has been a very, very popular space in the private equity community. And of course, there are obviously, you know, the very large distributors and, you know, some of the mid-market consolidators are public, but private equity, you know, has been a very, very nice home for a lot of the companies. They've been able to grow their business models, access the leveraged finance market, and access the private equity market in order to get the capital that they need to grow both organically and in some ways more notably through M&A. I think long-term that the trend of consolidation in the U.S. brokered space, you know, in the retail space is going to continue. And, you know, frankly, I think it'll continue in the wholesale space as well. I think that the business models benefit from scale. I think that, you know, at some point, the people who build these businesses as entrepreneurs decide that getting liquidity at the end of a long career is something that they're interested in doing. And passing a business from generation to generation has its own set of challenges. And there are so many platforms that are set up to actually provide back-end liquidity and actually provide synergies. I mean, fundamentally, the businesses are scale businesses. So I think the long-term trend that we've been seeing toward consolidation in the space and consolidation through M&A is very much going to continue. It's interesting, at this moment in time, the public broker multiples are actually higher, I guess, depending on the period that you mentioned, than they were pre-COVID. And I think some of that gets to hard market, right? The traditional thinking is that the brokers in some ways act as a leading indicator of hard markets. The other interesting thing that, you know, we've been talking about is the fact that T&E is a major expenditure within the brokered space, and T&E is way down. So margins are actually, you know, margins have held up very, very well. I think there are some top line organic challenges just because exposure units are down and we're in a deep economic recession here, but margins have been resilient. And I think the underlying business model, because it's a high margin business that benefits from scale, I think the underlying business model is very, very resilient, which is one of the reasons, by the way, that private equity and credit investors like the insurance distribution business so much, because when you think about sort of the ups and downs of the economy, that businesses have just proven to be very, very resilient. Look, in terms of how it could all play out, one of the things that we're seeing broadly in M&A structurally is the COVID outcome is a little bit binary if you think about it. So we could have a vaccine and get to herd immunity. If you listen to, you know, many of the experts, we could be in a very, very different position 12 months from now than where we are today. On the other hand, we don't really know, right? So the economy could continue to be in a tough spot for a period of time going forward. And so, you know, one of the things that a lot of our clients are thinking about is how do I plan for, you know, sort of a binary outcome? And structurally, one of the things that you can do is you can structure earnouts. So we're seeing a lot of people think about, if now is like a lousy time to sell, maybe I'll take back a paper from the acquirer. I can, you know, participate alongside them by retaining a stake or getting some levered upside in the form of a warrant or, you know, having some sort of earnout structure that allows for consideration depending on what type of environment we're in a year from now or 2 years from now. So that's one of the things that we're definitely seeing. And, you know, on the distribution side, I think that is the case as well. I think some of the conversations that we know of or that we've been involved in, people have suggested that, you know, some sort of a deferral mechanism might be an appropriate way to structure deals.
On the carrier side, how does the COVID-19 uncertainty play out there? And how do potential buyers get their arms around exposures?
Look, same idea. I think having some portion of consideration be deferred is one way to actually risk manage. You know, the other way is to, could we structure, you know, an adverse development cover, which, you know, frankly, that is actually tough though, right? Because that's just sort of passing an unknown risk from one pocket to another. So I do think this is a place where you just have to get creative, where if there's significant balance sheet exposure to COVID that, you know, you really don't know the answer to or don't have a direct way of addressing through traditional techniques, that's where you have to get creative in terms of having some sort of mechanism. But I'd say it's probably, you know, on the carrier side, to your point, David, it's probably even, you know, more intense discussion there than it is on the distribution side, because there you're talking about, you know, real balance sheet exposure that can sort of really cut at, you know, the value of a deal.
Just quickly jumping back onto the distribution side, where do you see the next wave of M&A within distribution and why?
Yeah, look, the dream scenario as an investment banker is that, you know, there could be some large retail mergers. But look, certainly, I just think that there's still tens of thousands of sort of, you know, small and medium-sized independent distributors. And, you know, it's sort of a tried and true path. So I think retail consolidation on that front will certainly continue. And then the bigger question is whether there can be actual consolidation or mergers between large retail platforms. And look, on the wholesale side, you're right. There really has now become over the last 10 years, you've now got sort of a big three. And I do think that, consolidation there happens both organically and through M&A, and I think that will continue too.
Well, thanks, Tom, and thanks to everyone for listening. In the next episode, which will air next week, we talk with Tom about low interest rates, debt financing, how carriers are looking to free up capital, the IPO market, and insurtech valuations.